Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the WELW Radio Pat O'Brien Chevrolet Community Spotlight Program for Tuesday, February 21st, 2006. Well, we are very pleased to have with us today in studio a guest who we're going to be talking with about some things of utmost importance: cyber terrorism, home computer security, and information security. We want to welcome to our show and say hello to Andrew Kolarik. Andrew Kolarik, PhD. Did I get that even close, Andrew?
Oh, absolutely. It's great to be here, Alan.
Well, it's nice to have you here. Now, all right, before we talk about the subject matter that I mentioned, let's find out a little bit about you. Are you from this area, and how did you get your training in these areas that we're going to be discussing?
Well, I was born in Cleveland, raised here, graduated from Lakewood High School. Went to Cuyahoga Community College, went to Lorain County Community College, went to Hiram, got my MBA from Kent, went overseas to do my doctorate in information security, chose to come back to Cleveland. It's a great place to be, lots of promise, and I try to help the community. I have my own consulting business here, helping businesses secure their assets, and so forth.
All right. Well, I've been looking forward to this conversation with you since I found out you were going to be here and the topics we're going to discuss. Now, of course, everybody knows that in the aftermath of the 9/11 disaster there in New York and down in Washington, D.C., we've all been kind of on a heightened security here, and we've talked a lot about things like the borders and port cities, and we've talked about the power plants around the area and what have you, but not a whole lot of talk, at least in the world that I've been living in, has been done about computers and the havoc that terrorists could wreak by getting into our computer system. So before we talk about cyber terrorism, let me ask you, am I right that there isn't a lot of talk about this? And if so, why isn't there more? This seems to be, like, critically important.
Well, you know, of our $10.5 or so trillion-dollar economy, and the world has only approximately $35 trillion annual GDP. Our whole information infrastructure is the key to our competitiveness. Mm-hmm. It's why we're able to do so much, be so efficient, so productive. Everything we do is stored now on the computers. All the computers now are internetworked. Mm-hmm. Access from global anywhere in the world. Now, there's millions of people out there with nothing better to do except try to break into systems.
Now, when we talk about cyber terrorism, first let's have a definition of that so that everybody's on the same page. What does that mean in our context right now?
Well, I could give you a nice big academic style definition, but I'm going to put it in its simplest form.
Okay.
The use of cyberspace, and that includes the total global information infrastructure, to create violence. And not just fear, not fearism, but actual violence. And let me give you several examples of
this. Please do.
The first, which I think is a classic example, is they capture these guys overseas and they behead them.
Okay.
They take video, they put that out on the websites, and they jazz it up to rap music and so forth. This is intended to be distributed throughout the internet, bypass all the media channels, and get into the hands of people who have absolutely nothing and probably will never be exposed to this type of violence. That's one good example. Another would be, we get certain sheiks from the Middle East who come here, Cleveland Clinic, phenomenal. They get heart surgery and so forth. What if somebody were to hack into the medical database right before an operation and change your blood type? I mean, this sounds almost dramatic, but we rely on these systems, and before we do anything, we check our records. I mean, that's part of our institutionalized process, and if the record's wrong, it's very difficult to change it. Just look at your credit reports.
Sure.
if somebody puts something bad in your credit report, it's a lot easier to put it into your record than to remove it.
Well, let me ask you now, when you watch TV and they talk about terrorists, you usually see a picture of bin Laden sitting in a cave somewhere or coming out of the cave, and then you see the recruits being trained on the monkey bars. And I know you've seen that one. That's from the file footage. So you don't get the impression by those two pictures, at least, that the terrorists that we're thinking of are that skilled in areas involving computers. Is, again, that just wrong on my part?
Well, listen, the majority of these terrorists in the 9/11 attack were highly educated, especially the leaders. They were educated all the way to a master's level in both European and other westernized institutions. They had engineering degrees. They had extensive computer skills. In fact, a lot of the plans that have been recovered from computer equipment through all these raids and the interventionist policies, the stuff that's coming from the computers show that people like Ramzi Youssef had encrypted, detailed plans for destroying the airliners. Now, encrypted, not just I have a Word document or I have a spreadsheet or a diagram, but they're actually using encryption. Now, for average people, we generally don't know how to use this. There, you know, there's a system called SCADA, which is Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition. We use these systems to control our railroads, our lightings, our lights, you know, for the streets. We use it for a whole host of electrical and water distribution systems and so forth. Those systems were reported to be on these systems. Websites that are run by the companies that use SCADA systems and sell SCADA systems have been viewed and mined for data from terrorist organizations. You know, there's engineering and structural data that were found on computers. On top of that, there's a concept called social engineering, where if, let's say, I call you and I say, "Hi, I'm tech support. I need you to give me your password," or "I need you to change your password to this. We're running a test," and you release that information to me, I might be able to access your system. Well, military systems have been attacked in this fashion by a fellow by the name of, now I'm really not very good with some of these names, Khalid Ibrahim, a member of the Pakistani terrorist group Harkat al-Ansar. So there are dedicated efforts. Now, I'm also going to point something out in my latest book, where there's a report back in 2002 that showed by RipTech that the number one attack from overseas on our systems by classification was power plants. Now think about this. I can understand going after a bank. I can understand going after a research company for intellectual property, but trying to break into a power plant, there's only one reason for that. You want to turn the lights off. So there's a huge economic infrastructure that people from overseas want to attack, have been attacking, continue to attack, and as they get better at this stuff, it's going to become even more dangerous.
So on 9/11 of 2001, if they had had a parallel attack on our computer systems here in the United States and could have taken out emergency interaction or just anything you can think of that works on a computer, and it's probably easier to think about things that don't work on a computer, but if that had been in place, it would have been, I mean, the lights would have been out and no correspondent. I mean, it would have been an even greater disaster.
Well, imagine this, the flight over Pennsylvania, what if they didn't have cell phones? What if someone broke into the network and downed the cell phone? What about the folks downtown New York who did not have cell phone use or internet use? The emergency response people would have an absolute fit. So a lot of these attacks on the electronic side can be used as a force multiplier.
What does that mean?
Well, what it means is, if my intent is to injure, 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make 1,000,000 panic as a result instead of the people in direct proximity, then I'm going to turn off the communication mm-hmm. and the electrical. And in fact, if let's say a dirty bomb were to go off, you know, you're going to need hospitals with power, communications mm-hmm. for the emergency people, the ambulances. It's, if all that went out, think about how many more people would die in the aftermath of an attack.
Mm-hmm.
So, now, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you here now. I remember in the days leading up to Y2K, when there were a lot of predictions that things were going to fall apart, and people that were involved with computers did like a space race kind of a thing where they all got in there and did all of these things, and New Year's came and nothing happened. Are the folks that are working with computers attacking this, and maybe that's the wrong word, Are they looking at this? Are they dealing with the security with the same intensity as they did with Y2K? Or are they living in a fool's paradise?
Well, a lot of the prevention that needs to occur out there is happening in the laboratory.
Okay.
There's a lot of research, a lot of publications, a lot of mechanisms, and you know, such as security protocols and so forth. But there is no cost feasibility for implementing these things. Now, if you take a look at the U.S. military, they have a very secure system.
Mm-hmm.
But they've recently acknowledged that they've had some issues, and they're going to put in a brand new infrastructure. But even if our public infrastructure had 50% of what they do,
mm-hmm.
it would be a 1,000% improvement. Also, I want to point out that it's not always the computer assets that are important. It's not necessarily securing the internet service provider, but it's also securing the information.
I see. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. You know, we could explore this and go on through past the half hour mark, but we're not able to do that. So I want to get to the other two areas that we talked about. And the second one is information security. Now, are we talking, and I presume we are, we're talking not just about me and the internet when I give my Visa number or whatever, but we're talking about the Visa people on the other line and what they do with the number, right?
You're talking about both sides.
Yes. Okay.
Listen. If you go to a bank and you ask them about internet banking, they will tell you their system is secure. And their system is secure on their end.
Okay.
The majority of the penetrations occur when your home computer or your business computer has a virus or spyware or a keyboard logger and records your username and password. Or that username and password is transmitted to the bank and that's picked up by an eavesdropper in between. Now, once somebody has that information, they can go into your account, do a one-off payment, transfer it out of the country, whatever. And if you read your user agreement, you're responsible mm-hmm. for it.
So this wouldn't necessarily be a terrorist, although it could be trying to get funds, but it could also just be somebody trying to rip us off for our money. How do we prevent this? We get those guards, and forgive me, I didn't use the right nomenclature there, but you get those controls on computers that are supposed to ferret these things out. Are they like, what, 90%, 95%, 100%? How good are they generally?
Well, it really depends on what the system is, what it's designed to do versus what it's being used for. The people who configure it when it's installed, who maintains it, it's a dynamic system. Also, you have all of your partners. All right? If you're a company and you have a high-speed internet connection, you also have an internet service provider. You have throughput. You're within a greater network. And so there's a whole host of issues that go with securing everything in a holistic manner. Right now, it's piecemeal. So while some security is better than no security, and a lot of the security that's out there really goes a long way, there's so much more that needs to be done.
So if I'm part of this big kind of a spider web of a thing, and they get into me, they can take all those little spider webs and get into all of those other ones all around the world just by getting into me.
Well, they can hijack your systems and use it to attack other systems. Mm-hmm. They can use your connections. In other words, if I come in through one connection and you have five more, mm-hmm. I now have access to those five.
Okay.
Also, and what's most dangerous about it is once they're in your system, they may not do anything to your system. This isn't like the old day of the hackers where they just crashed your system.
Mm-hmm.
Now they sit and monitor. Now they've designed the viruses and the worms to sit and monitor your transactions.
Now what's the point of that?
Because it's called opportunity.
Okay.
If I wait long enough, you're going to transmit something or make a transaction that I can then get a big payoff. Rather than being destructive, the trend now is to become more of a cyber criminal.
I see.
To actually get financial gain.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what goes on a lot in Russia. Now, China's more geared towards information warfare, but the Russians, they're all about getting the money. And a lot of hackers now are following suit.
So should I never get online and pay a bill or put in any kind of a number that I wouldn't want to get out? Is that the best safeguard?
Let me give you what I tell some of my clients.
Okay.
For internet banking, have two accounts. One that is internet enabled, that you mm-hmm. keep a minimum balance. Then take your bank card, go to an ATM machine, and once a week or once every 2 weeks, dump a little money to pay your bills online. Now, if someone does happen to get in, there's nothing for them to take, and your source original account is not internet enabled, and they can't touch it.
Okay.
So what we have to now do is we have to think beyond our serviceability and start managing the problem ourselves.
Okay, so in essence, if my house payment is $1, I put $1.25 in there, and the most they can get is $1.25, and I put the rest of my income in an account that they can't get to because it's non-internet accessible.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, that's a good idea there. Now, are there some other tips you can give us about how we can still use the internet but have some idea that we're somewhat secure?
Well, let me give you a small list.
Okay.
I know
he just took out a ream of paper. No, he didn't.
I know that your listeners have a pad of paper while they're driving down the highway. In any event, what you want, first of all, there's a concept called physical security. Where your computer is and who has access to it. Sometimes it's easier just to unplug the CPU or take the laptop and walk away with it. And anything you had stored on it, I can then retrieve it later.
I see.
Password or no password.
Mm-hmm.
Log on or no log on. So the first thing is secure where your computer is. If it's downstairs next to the sliding door that you leave wide open, you're asking for trouble.
So the computer that you let sit in the den while you go to the Super Bowl for the weekend, if somebody broke in, they could take that and get in there and glean any information that was in there, even if they didn't have any code words or anything that they needed.
Yes, because there's a lot of tools out there that you can download from the internet that let you penetrate and bypass the operating system security.
Okay.
So they can go right after the data. Now, the next thing that I recommend is we use the browser, the web browser, because mm-hmm. it's the World Wide Web. Browsers, by their nature, are insecure. Now, you have things like Internet Explorer and you have Firefox, which is supposed to be secure. Well, the moment you're a big name, you become a big target.
Mm-hmm.
So don't rely on marketing. You have to configure these browsers and maintain their update status in order to maintain certain security. There's also a host of other things that other books and other experts will tell you how to configure and modify. So you basically need to restrict the browser and keep it updated. The next thing is an antivirus. If you don't have an antivirus, you're living in a delusional world. 97% of the folks out there have antivirus protection. But all it takes is that 3% who sends you an email, and now you're infected. In fact, in my Home Executive's Guide to Computer Security, my father sent me a virus via email mm-hmm. because he didn't update his antivirus. And I use that as the example. The next thing is firewalls.
I'm sorry, before you go to that, how did your relative get the virus? How did that get into his system?
Well, he may have inadvertently gotten it by surfing the web. Certain websites will infect you just by visiting. It's that simple?
It's that simple. Wow.
Okay. He might have gotten it from somebody else who sent him an email.
Now, do those folks who do that, like you say, you visit a website, do they know that they're doing that? Is that intentional or is it unintentional?
Well, it could be both.
Okay.
Some sites are, hey, come and download something for free, and they set you up. Other sites may have been penetrated by hackers and set up to infect others.
Now, so the idea here is if you get an email from somebody and you don't know who it is, delete that little devil, huh?
Absolutely. In fact, you shouldn't even leave your preview pane on. You should not be looking at anything. Okay. Just by opening up that preview, you may infect your system.
Oh, wow. Now, you started to talk about firewalls, and I apologize, I cut you off. You know what? We're already at 25 after 5 here, and we haven't gotten to the third topic here. This is fascinating, and maybe there are folks out there who know all this, but I'm willing to bet that there are a lot of folks who are sitting there like me, sitting here saying, I didn't know that. Wow. Because I just think a little old me getting on the computer, who's going to want to get into my stuff? I'm just kind of, messing around here. But I guess there's people out there that might want to spy on me just in case, huh?
Well, listen, if I could hack into your system, I stated before, I might use it as like a drone to launch other attacks, but I also may want to check your financial transactions. But more than that, a lot of the stuff we do online might not be something you want in the public light. So blackmail becomes, especially you being a public figure.
Yeah. Now, how it could happen anywhere. They could be sitting in Lower Moldova or whatever that country was in that film. They could be anywhere, and they don't have to have a big room filled with computers. Just one could do it?
One computer with an internet connection. And by the way, the vast majority of large cities throughout the world have internet cyber cafes. Where they can go in and they can use the cafe in an anonymous fashion and do these things. A lot of us have our own internet service provider. But the fact of the matter is, if you can borrow somebody else's, now how do you trace them? So, and there are ways of tracing them and going after them, but these guys can be quite clever.
Now, let me ask you, this may sound silly, but if I want to break into your house, I could probably figure out how to do it. But where do you learn to break in to a computer? Where do you get that knowledge?
There are about 1,000 different sites out on the web that will teach you how to be a great hacker,
really?
How to crack games, how to turn credit cards into money. There are sites where if you give somebody, let's say, 25 credit card numbers and names, they'll give you free downloads. They'll credit your account for certain things. I mean, this is a giant black market e-commerce environment.
Well, this is weird because I remember a number of months ago I was kind of playing around on the computer and I found my father's social security number, and then I thought, well, gee, I'll try to find some other people, and I found my grandfather's and realized they were consecutive numbers. Why are they putting, I mean, they're both deceased, but why would they put any social security number on the web? I mean, it's just saying, well, that person's deceased, you can use it, and they won't. Who did that?
Well, there's a lot of law and initiatives going on now about trying to prevent identity theft. And we use all of these numbers like they're candy. We talk about them. If you go to the bank, they ask for it out loud. You're reading these things off. And with all these personal recorders, I can get all kinds of information. I can order birth certificates. I can renew certain subscriptions. I can get a whole host of information. One of the things that I state in my latest book, Cyber Terrorism, Political and Economic Implications, is that we absolutely need to turn information, personal information, into a property right so that it is not bought, sold, bartered, transferred, stored indefinitely, and so forth. A lot of this stuff, a lot of the identity theft that's going on out there is just because we are addicted to this information.
Well, you know what? I hate to stop you there, but the clock is the enemy here. It's 29 after the hour, and we have some other things coming up. But please, I hope you'll come back and
we'll
talk more about these things. I find it fascinating and very informative on how these things work and how we can protect ourselves. So if you will, mark down, we'll have you back, and we'll talk more about this, all right?
Thank you, Alan.
All right. Thank you, Andrew.